Trump disses Sessions again today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump raises more doubts about Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
I am disappointed in the Attorney General. He should not have recused himself.
But Trump's Russia problem just won't go away. This week, that means hearings about Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer. Bill Browder will testify. He did business in Russia and got in trouble after speaking out against corruption there. His message? The Russia-Trump story may be overhyped, but concerns about Putin are not.
He's a man who's accumulated vast amounts of money by expropriating money from people, from kidnapping them, torturing them. It's kind of like a mafia boss. It's like Pablo Escobar with nukes.
Those stories and more today right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. I am disappointed in the Attorney General. That's what President Trump said today at a joint press conference with the Prime Minister of Lebanon in Washington.
I want the Attorney General to be much tougher on the leaks from intelligence agencies, which are leaking like rarely have they ever leaked before at a very important level. These are intelligence agencies. We cannot have that happen. You know many of my views in addition to that, but I think that's one of the very important things that they have to get on with. I told you before, I'm very disappointed with the Attorney General, but we will see what happens. Time will tell.
The president has made it clear that he's deeply unhappy that Sessions recused himself from the investigation into Russia's meddling in the U.S. elections and any potential links with the Trump campaign. I have The World's Matthew Bell here with me. So Trump appeared with the Prime Minister of Lebanon today at the White House. Before we get into any stuff about Sessions, why is Hariri there in Washington?
Right. This is a good question, and it's a good reminder that, you know, if even if none of this stuff, this Russia investigation, the stuff about personnel and all these wheels turning in Washington, even if none of that was happening, you would still have challenges on the horizon for American foreign policy. And this is a good example. The prime minister from Lebanon was here undoubtedly at the top of his agenda was to talk about U.S. funding for the Lebanese military. Washington has been funding the Lebanese army for 10, 12 years to the tune of like $1.5 billion. That's a lot of money. Today, when the two leaders came out and spoke, they talked sort of singing from the same song sheet about shared values and cooperation, especially in the fight against ISIS and extremism. Donald Trump praised the Lebanese prime minister and the Lebanese military. We've also got a clip here of one thing that Donald Trump went out of his way to talk about, and that is the Shiite militant group Hezbollah.
Hezbollah is a menace to the Lebanese state, the Lebanese people, and the entire region. The group continues to increase its military arsenal, which threatens to start yet another conflict with Israel.
I think what's interesting here, Marco, is that the president talked about Hezbollah, talked about supporting the Lebanese military quite clearly. But what we didn't hear is sort of a commitment. And that comes in the context of the Trump administration's priority, which they say is America first. And I think, you know, when you see an image like the Lebanese prime minister standing there with the American president, this is a reminder that America has lots of partners and depends on these partners all over the world, and that these are tricky relationships. These are big, tricky questions. The Hezbollah thing is a great example. Hezbollah is on the terrorist list and considered by Washington to be a terrorist group, but it's also part of the Lebanese government. So when Donald Trump talks about supporting Lebanon, supporting the Lebanese army on the one hand, this gets really complicated really fast. And these are tricky issues that it certainly sounds to me like the Trump administration is getting its feet, you know, is getting started in a lot of ways. And then you have the other big stories going on inside Washington.
Right. Well, on paper and with the Lebanese prime minister by Trump's side, it should have been all Mideast all the time. But the first question out of the box when they started taking questions from the press was about Attorney General Jeff Sessions and whether Trump had lost confidence in him. What did you hear?
Of course. Yeah. predictably, this was the first question because there's a lot of speculation about it. What struck me was that Donald Trump is not backing off his criticism. And he's sort of mocking Jeff Sessions, which is astounding to a lot of people, me included, given that Sessions has from the very beginning been such a strong supporter of Donald Trump. What we didn't hear is really new criticisms. We didn't hear anything that I hadn't heard before. Trump is very upset that Sessions recused himself. He wants Sessions to go after leakers more forcefully. And we also didn't really get a sense of where he's headed on this. He seemed to me to be really kind of tight-lipped and didn't want to give – I mean, or maybe he's still figuring out what to do. But it's hard to say what the timeline is and what he's going to do.
Final question and a very brief answer. Can Sessions survive this?
This is the million-dollar question, right? And there's multiple investigations going on, and Donald Trump has some big decisions to make here.
The World's Matthew Bell, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
So first up, it was Jared Kushner answering questions on Capitol Hill. Next up, Trump's son, Donald Jr., and his former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, have been called to testify before a Senate panel. It's all about that meeting in Trump Tower last summer with a Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya. There's another person set to testify before that Senate panel, Bill Browder, and he's at the center of what that Russian lawyer wanted to talk about at Trump Tower. Browder is an American and was once a major investor in Russia, but in 2005, he became vocal about corruption there. His lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was sent to a Russian prison and died under mysterious circumstances. That sparked international outrage and later a U.S. law called the Magnitsky Act. It put sanctions on Russian officials accused of human rights abuses, and it is a major point of conflict with the Kremlin. I asked Bill Browder to explain the connection between those sanctions and his testimony tomorrow.
This is a very specific hearing to discuss foreign agents running around Washington and not registering as foreign agents when they're conducting their influence campaigns. And I'm going to be talking about the anti-Magnitsky campaign to repeal sanctions that a group of Russians headed by Natalia Veselnitskaya were doing and how none of these lobbyists registered under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. I'll be telling that story, and hopefully my testimony will lead to strengthening of those rules going forward.
Allegedly, your name was inside a plastic folder of documents that Ms. Veselnitskaya was going to hand over to Donald Trump Jr. What was in that envelope?
I don't think we know specifically what was in the envelope, but we know that Natalia Veselnitskaya had been on a mission on behalf of the general prosecutor of Russia and on behalf of Vladimir Putin to try to dismantle and repeal the Magnitsky Act, which imposes sanctions on Russian torturers and murderers in the United States, including those who killed Sergei Magnitsky. And in order to do that, one of her big tasks was to try to discredit me because I was the one who had convinced members of Congress and members of other lawmaking bodies around the world of what had happened to Sergei. And she wanted to change that story and try to get this piece of legislation repealed.
Do you know what was in that folder, though?
I know in vague terms that it was a folder constructed of various stale and disproven allegations against me by the Russian government for tax evasion that they had made many years ago as part of their efforts to try to discredit me. And she was basically sort of rehashing and reusing that and trying to hand that around to people in Trump Tower and other places.
There's been so much speculation about Natalia Veselnitskaya and her role. Have you ever met her?
I have indeed. She also, in addition to her main task of trying to repeal the Magnitsky Act and smear me, her other task was that her Russian client, a family called the Katsiv family, were recipients of some of the $230 million tax rebate fraud that Sergei Magnitsky, my lawyer, had uncovered and exposed. They were recipients of that money, and that money went into New York real estate. And the Department of Justice, the U.S. law enforcement agencies, had seized the property. I was the key witness for the U.S. government in their prosecution against these people. And so she was in a deposition hearing in which the defense was deposing me, and that was my opportunity to sit across the table from her.
So Reuters has reported that Veselnitskaya did legal work for the FSB, the successor to the KGB. What do you know about her intelligence ties?
What we know about her is that she's the main representative for this Katsiv family. The Katsiv family is headed by a man named Pyotr Katsiv. Pyotr Katsiv is a very senior member of the Putin regime. He was the minister of transport for the Moscow region, which is a region the size of France. He's currently the vice president of Russian Railways. Russian Railways is a Russian state-owned company, which is next most important after the state gas company, Gazprom. And she was doing work for them, paid by them, their sort of in-house lawyer. We also know from her own admission and from the admissions of other people that she's working hand in glove with Yuri Chaika, who's the general prosecutor of Russia, who also has been involved very deeply in the Magnitsky affair and the Magnitsky cover-up. And then we know that she's had a number of other clients like this FSB, which is the Russian secret police. And so what all this says to me is that she's a senior sort of operative for Russian state interests, that she takes her instructions from a very high level. And any of her statements that she's just a simple lawyer having had this strange meeting on her own volition is complete nonsense.
So news organizations, and you kind of touched on this, are running with this story like we've not seen for a while. Don't you see some two-dimensional portrayals of Russians these days in the media, even some hysteria over any of U.S. communication with Russia?
I lived in Russia for 10 years. I'm married to a Russian. My staff is Russian. I've got great affection for many Russians. And I think that the issue is not Russia per se. The issue is Putin. And if you speak to Russian politicians, opposition politicians, there's many, many good people in Russia. What isn't good and what is evil is the Putin regime. And I don't think that the world is tough enough on all of these terrible things that the Putin regime does. But I think that everyone kind of gets all the Russians get mixed up in this thing. Having said that, anybody who's connected to the Putin regime should be considered to be suspect and working for an agenda that's against the interests of the United States and liberal democracy in the West.
So pulling the lens back a little bit, your grandfather, Earl Browder, was the chairman of the American Communist Party. He went to jail for his beliefs. Red baiting, certainly an issue that haunted him. Do you think there's a different sort of red baiting today? And is it complicating what you're trying to accomplish?
Back in the days of my grandfather, whether you agreed with his politics or not, it was all about ideology. Now what you have is a Putin regime, which is all about criminality. It's all about money, stealing money and keeping that money safe. And so from where I sit, I think that the world is actually hasn't quite woken up to this criminal threat of Vladimir Putin yet. Many people still describe him as a sort of legitimate sovereign leader as opposed to this crime boss. And so I think that there's not enough analysis and understanding of what this man is really up to and what his intentions are in relation to the West, which is not good for us.
Considering what happened to your lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, and your own kind of central role in all of this, whether you like it or not, how far do you think the power of Putin extends?
Well, Vladimir Putin is an immensely powerful man. He doesn't have the same constraints that any other world leader has. He has no parliament to keep him in check. There's no free press to expose him. There's no judiciary to stop him. And there's no democracy to oust him. So he can wake up any day and decide to do anything he wants. And this is a man with all the resources of a sovereign state, all these nuclear weapons. And so he can go around and make mischief and cause trouble in ways that nobody else would ever have the capacity to do because he's so independent in his ability to do that. And the most important thing to understand is that he's a criminal. He's a man who's accumulated vast amounts of money by expropriating money from people, from kidnapping them, torturing them, killing them like they did with Sergei Magnitsky. And he has this freedom to go around and commit these crimes. It's kind of like a mafia boss. It's like Pablo Escobar with nukes.
Are you concerned about your own safety here in the United States?
He has threatened me. His government has threatened me. They've tried all sorts of different tools and tricks to have me arrested, to be sent back to Russia. They're after me in every possible way you can imagine.
Bill Browder, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Bill Browder heads the Global Magnitsky Justice Campaign. He's also the author of the expose Red Notice.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, Love and Quantum Physics. Our own Ari Daniel knows something about both, and he's here in the studio with me. Hey, Ari.
Hi, Marco.
So I got to say, I usually look at the topic line for stories in the show, and I have at least a pretty good idea of what they're about from a few words. But with this one, no clue.
Well, Marco, one thing that love and quantum physics have in common, they're both really mysterious. We don't really understand how either of them works, but they also share what scientists call entanglement. People get entangled with each other when they fall in love, and it turns out that tiny subatomic particles might also get entangled with each other in a very bizarre way.
So I gather you've been speaking with some physicists about this whole idea of entangled particles, but you also went to a play that takes a look at some of the parallels between these two kinds of entanglement.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's a bit of a mind blower. So stick with me. I think you'll get drawn in the way I did. But if you get lost, I'm going to stick around so we can talk a bit more afterwards.
Okay, the world's Ari Daniel. Here we go.
It's date night in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
This was actually a surprise for my one-month anniversary with my boyfriend, so I didn't know until I got here what it was.
Idalina Gomez is out with her boyfriend, Kadeem McIntosh. And why did you think he surprised you with this event?
Because it involves love.
She was kind of like surprised, like, oh, really? We're going to a scientific view and understanding of love? And I was like, yeah, we are.
And not just love, also the nature of the universe. I mean, the venue for the evening is MIT. And the program is called Love and Other Entanglements. It's built around a reading of a new play about wonder and an experiment trying to prove a bizarre quirk in physics.
What if our fate is not only our own? What if parts of us are entangled with parts of other things?
The experiment in question was designed to show whether a special kind of entanglement is real, quantum entanglement.
Entangled particles break the rules. They are influenced by each other instantly, no matter how far apart they were.
I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't like it. Spuk after fiend bekund.
That's what Einstein called it. Spooky action at a distance.
This really strange phenomenon.
This is David Kaiser, a real guy, not an actor in the play. He's a physicist at MIT and part of the team responsible for the experiment. Under certain circumstances, Kaiser says, two particles, like two electrons or two particles of light, become connected.
Somehow what happens to one particle can have an impact on what we would expect the second one to do, even if those particles are nowhere near each other.
But how can it be like that?
Crazy, right? Einstein thought so too. When this idea first surfaced over 80 years ago, he dismissed the whole thing as nonsense.
Spuk after fiend bekund.
But over time, experiments were designed to test the idea.
And scientists proved it?
Proved is a strong word.
Because there have always been loopholes in the idea. One by one, experiments have sewn these loopholes shut. But one's remained.
And now,
the last major loophole, settings independence.
Was there any kind of third party in the past that could have nudged the behavior of those particles?
In other words, could someone or something have messed with the particles to make it just look like they were entangled?
Sometimes quantum mechanics make my head hurt.
It's something you cannot understand with your usual common sense.
Anton Zeilinger is another real-life physicist based at the University of Vienna. He's a wizard at devising ingenious ways to perform quantum experiments in the real world. He's got this special laser that makes thousands of pairs of entangled particles of light. Then he splits the laser and shoots the entangled particles in opposite directions.
I find these outdoors experiments extremely charming.
To work on closing this last possible loophole, Zeilinger and his lab fired up their laser on top of a building in the middle of Vienna.
They were shooting lasers through the night sky.
And at the same time, they were pointing telescopes towards two stars more than 600 light years away. The idea was that in the time it took the laser to shoot its particles across Vienna, the telescopes could use that ancient starlight to make measurements on those particles.
So that the decision of what measurements to perform on these entangled particles here on Earth would be selected by events that happened very far away, very long ago.
So when that light arrived, the particle detector was set, and that light started traveling to Earth 600 years ago.
Long before anyone living today was born.
And David Kaiser says the results couldn't be clearer.
We have shoved this loophole back by a factor of 10 million billion.
Which is to say, the loophole's almost completely closed. but not entirely. So for their next experiment, the physicists will use light sources located 3 to 4 billion light years away.
We want to be able to say we've put our most fundamental theories of nature through the ringer.
Scientists want to make the loophole so small it almost doesn't exist.
Which proves
that quantum physics and entanglement really does describe how the universe works, even if Einstein didn't like it.
Boom!
Okay, so quantum entanglement's real. Scientists have nearly proven it works. As for how it works, well, that's another question. And even these scientists basically say they still don't have a clue. But what was all that talk back at the beginning about love?
What really nailed it for me was this kind of freedom of choice or spooky action in the distance. These particles are more entangled than we can kind of believe.
Kadeem McIntosh says he and Idalina Gomez are leaving the performance with a deeper sense of connection, or at least of the weirdness of entanglement, quantum and human.
Our rational world above,
solid and sensible,
and below,
a world with different rules,
wondrous and mystifying in everyone.
End of play.
The world's Ari Daniel there, diving into the world of quantum physics and living to tell the tale. So I think I get this, Ari. Weird as it may seem that we've got tiny particles across light years of space can get their fates caught up together, kind of like two people catching each other's eyes for the first time in a room.
Exactly. Weird, but apparently true.
So it is mysterious. And did I hear you say that there are physicists who pretty much have proven that this happens, but they still don't actually know how?
Right. It's still spooky, to use Einstein's word.
Okay. One more question. It is fascinating stuff. But now that we know this, how does it help?
You're not the only one who wants to know that. And it turns out it actually is good for something. I talked to another physicist about this question. His name is Alan Guth. He's also at MIT. And he started by telling me this.
In the foreseeable future, we will actually have computers that make use of this entanglement, and they could do calculations vastly faster than computers that we now use.
So computers that use quantum entanglement, I think we should leave the question of how those would work for another day, but I guess there is more.
Yes. Here's the other thing that Guth told me.
By using these entanglement techniques, you can send messages which literally cannot be intercepted without your knowing about it.
Wow, unhackable messages?
Yeah, and maybe even unhackable electronic voting.
Wow, tantalizing. The world's Ari Daniel with some really fascinating and out-of-this-world stuff. Thanks very much.
It was my pleasure, Marco.
That play, by the way, is called Both and is by Boston-based playwright Patrick Gabridge. If you happen to live around Boston, there are still a few performances coming up, so grab your Entangled and head on over to MIT. We've got more information at PRI.org.
I Like Words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentil.
The world in words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World.
My whole family works here. My wife does the books. I got my.
This man from North Dakota has manufactured industrial drill bits for decades. Last year, he got government help selling them overseas.
Australia, Belgium, Zimbabwe.
And his profits took off. That story from North Dakota, just ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've got a new project here on The World. It's called 50 States. We're visiting communities in every state to hear how the global economy is affecting you. This week, we're looking at North Dakota. Rural companies there have been turning to the U.S. government to help grow exports. The program is working, and local businesses would like even more help from Washington. But it doesn't look like it's coming under the Trump administration. The world's Jason Margolis has our story.
Kevin Christensen owns and operates the four-person Palmer Bit Company out of his shop in Williston, North Dakota.
My whole family works here. My wife does the books. I got my two sons here in the shop, and I do the office work.
Do you get along with your sons working with them, or do you guys drive each other crazy? Or
yes.
The family produces drill bits. Big ones.
You know, we're talking, this bit's 250 pounds.
Christensen's bits can bore miles into the earth to explore for minerals, water, and oil. He's been making drill bits for over 40 years. For the first 39, he didn't try to sell them internationally. Then last year, he went global, chalking up sales in 19 countries.
New Zealand, Australia, Belgium, Zimbabwe.
His revenues shot way up.
22%. For a little company, it's massive. It's huge for us.
Christensen credits his growth to one person with the U.S. Commerce Department, and he's not exaggerating by giving international trade specialist Heather Rank all the credit.
I am the only person covering all of North Dakota and 9 counties of northwest Minnesota as well.
Okay, she has some help.
If I didn't have interns supporting me here, I would not be able to do it.
What she's doing is coming up with targeted export plans for rural companies. This has been difficult for government trade specialists, especially in lower population states where budgets have been thin for more than a decade.
It's been very challenging to fill unfilled positions, and our staffing has declined pretty significantly.
Is that over the last year, 5 years, 10 years?
It's been since I've started here, 11 years. We've never really had an ability to staff.
Don't expect that to change anytime soon. President Trump's spending plan proposes cutting the Commerce Department's budget by 16%. I pressed Rank about that.
I think I'm not supposed to comment on stuff like that.
Rank is a civil servant who serves the president, regardless of party. What she will say is this. American companies need a boost.
The U.S. significantly underperforms for exporting compared to all the other OECD countries. We're in dead last place. A lot of companies view exporting as icing on the cake instead of part of their business plan. So that's my job, is getting them to view it as an integral part of their business.
Rank let me sit in on a meeting with a new client introducing the export program she streamlined.
I like to do a 9-step process where you start with the worldwide analysis of countries. You guys pick 3 that you want us to focus on.
Rank is speaking with Spectrum Aeromed, a manufacturer of medical equipment used in airplanes and helicopters.
I mean, if you were to think of an ideal market, what would you look for? Now, we talked about number of planes.
Spectrum's chief operating officer, Chad Cost, says they're already selling their products in a few countries, but are looking to expand to Asia.
China, for sure.
Okay.
Thailand. The Philippines.
With her marching orders, Rank and her interns will spend the next 4 to 6 weeks doing research and combing through government databases. Then, Rank explains, Spectrum will be able to further tap into the unrivaled power of the U.S. government.
So, let's say you picked Greece. And we actually have an office in Greece, in the U.S. Embassy, and they can actually proactively go out and contact some of these people we found and others that they would know because they're in the country.
All of this will cost Spectrum about $1,500. A private consultant might charge $50,000 for this type of research, and that's without the on-the-ground connection from U.S. embassies. North Dakota businessman Tom Shorma says exports are a lifeline for local companies. He chairs the North Dakota Export Council, a volunteer organization.
North Dakota is a small population state. There's just over 700,000 total people in the state. So we have to sell what we grow and or manufacture to other states or other countries.
Shorma argues it's actually easier these days to find new customers in Brazil than in New York or Texas. Problem is, again, resources. But he says if Washington is serious about creating jobs and boosting the nation's GDP, they should focus on exports. After all, 95% of the globe's potential customers reside outside the U.S., and there are already government resources in place to help American companies reach them. For The World, Jason Margolis, Fargo, North Dakota.
Tomorrow, for 50 States, we head to the North Dakota oil town, Williston.
A lot of the stories that you would read about from the Wild West out here, it really was. It was the Wild West on steroids.
Williston boomed, but now, well, it's not exactly a bust, but things have certainly slowed down.
A breath catcher is the way we're thinking about it here in Williston.
If you'd like to be part of our 50 states coverage, go to PRI.org and tell us more about your story and your state, or just tweet us using the hashtag 50 states. We are learning more now about the people who died in that sweltering tractor trailer on Sunday. The truck made a stop at a Walmart in San Antonio, Texas, and then dozens of immigrants were found to be packed in the trailer with no ventilation. Some of them tried to call family on their cell phones to ask for help.
We're trapped in this trailer. It's dark. There's no oxygen. We can't breathe.
By the time the doors were opened, 8 people had died. 2 more later died at the hospital. Kate Linthicum is following the story for the Los Angeles Times.
Well, we know more about who were the victims in this human trafficking case. We found out that among the dead, there was a young man who had spent much of his life in the U.S., a former DACA recipient, who had been deported to Guatemala and was trying to get back to his home or to his family in Maryland. There was a number of Mexican immigrants who were trying to migrate for the first time, who also were among the dead.
That 20-year-old you were just talking about, you wrote about him in your story for the LA Times, Frank Giuseppe Fuentes. Why did he get on that truck? What's his backstory?
So the Guatemalan Consul General shared a few details about his case. It appears he had spent much of his life growing up in Maryland, and because of that, he had been able to apply for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that former President Obama started, which basically granted deportation protection to people who had been brought to the U.S. as kids. He lost that protection after being convicted of a crime or some crimes. The consul general didn't say what those crimes had been, and he was deported to Guatemala. Apparently, Frank was trying to get back to his family in Maryland, and that's why he had undertaken this very dangerous journey.
Right, 20 years old. Was he born in the U.S.?
No, he was born in Guatemala and had apparently been brought to the U.S. by his family,
right,
which is why he was eligible for that DACA protection.
Gotcha. But having spent so much time in the U.S., it's very likely that when he got back to Guatemala, there was very little he recognized there.
Sure. I mean, I've talked to a lot of deported migrants in Central America or in Mexico who say, you know, I may have been born in Mexico, but I spent my life in U.S. schools and, you know, doing American things, and I'm just not Mexican. So it's this really uncomfortable adjustment that a lot of deportees have to make, and many of them decide it's worth it to risk, you know, going back to the U.S.
In 2003, there was a similar tragedy that happened near the border, also in Texas, that was 14 years ago, and yet people are smuggled all the time. Are fatalities, when people are smuggled in the back of a truck, are they just rare, or do we not hear about them all that much?
I mean, I think everyone is in agreement that it's getting more and more dangerous to cross the border. You know, as we try to ramp up border security and make it more difficult to cross, people are going to be forced to take more dangerous routes. One interesting sort of aspect of this case that came out in the federal complaint against the driver of the truck yesterday, investigators talked with some of the survivors who said they had paid smugglers, but it had also paid directly to a Mexican drug cartel, the Zetas, for protection in making this passage. About 7 years ago, 60 migrants were slaughtered by a drug cartel in northern Mexico. You know, as we make the border more difficult to cross, we're kind of giving more business to Mexican criminal groups, which in recent years have diversified away from just drug smuggling to human trafficking, oil stealing and trafficking, and extortion. So in certain ways, this is potentially actually kind of strengthening the criminal groups along the border.
Wow, those economics hadn't even occurred to me. What's going to happen to the migrants now? Will they be deported?
That's a good question. I mean, I talked yesterday to the brother of one of the men who had been in the back of the truck. He was traveling to the U.S. along with his uncle, who had made this desperate call back to the family in Mexico on Sunday saying, "We're trapped in this trailer. It's dark. There's no oxygen. We can't breathe." He had begged his parents, his family in Mexico, to try to call the smuggler to get the driver of the truck to let them out. You know, he and his nephew are now in the hospital. The nephew hasn't actually woken up. He seems to be suffering from severe dehydration. And the family is mostly worried about his health, but they told me they're also worried about what immigration authorities are going to do to these migrants now. There are some protections for migrants who've been the victims of crimes in the U.S., including human trafficking. So potentially they could be eligible for it's called a U visa for victims of crimes. But this family, at least, didn't have a tremendous amount of hope that their injured family members would be treating well in Trump's America.
Kate Linthicum with the Los Angeles Times, thank you very much for your time and for the update.
Thank you so much.
a convention in London for psychedelics called Breaking Convention. Appropriate pun considering this was a hall filled with people who are tapping into the mind-altering culture of shamanic doctors all over the world. Very unconventional. But back in the 60s, London was one of the centers for this cultural and chemical-induced revolution. 50 years later, psychedelics are on the rebound, but it's different this time round, as our own Leo Hornack found out when he met some of the consciousness explorers at Breaking Convention.
Well, there's quite a range of activities I could take part in at this convention. There's a chance for some shamanic journeying. Behind me, there's an experiment you can join to explore the nature of consciousness. There's also conscious kink. Sounds a bit safer than unconscious kink.
It was 50 years ago today, or more or less today, that Britain went psychedelic. A generation of music, culture, and creativity refracted through the power of mind-altering substances. But in the last few years, something of that spirit's been coming back in a new way.
Well, by and large, the substances used are very much the same. Magic mushrooms, LSD, mescaline.
Stephen Reed is the founder of Britain's Psychedelic Society and one of the organisers of this weekend's Breaking Convention, a conference for hundreds of people exploring new forms of consciousness. For what it's worth, Steve's the first person I've interviewed who spontaneously adopts the lotus position when I ask to take his photo. We're living through a new renaissance in psychedelia, he says.
There's been a huge growth of people obtaining these substances through the dark net. People are able to go and buy and sell these substances, and they will arrive through your letterbox 2 or 3 days later, just as you'd ordered something from Amazon or eBay.
It's that eBayization of mind-altering chemicals which has allowed events like this to flourish. And some aspects of psychedelic culture don't seem to have changed that much. Walking around the convention, there's a lot of paisley about, a lot of tie-dyed T-shirts, and quite a few white guy dreadlocks. There's also another side, a side which seeks to do serious medical research into how LSD or ecstasy works, and if it can be used to help people with PTSD or mental health problems. There's also something very English about the tone of Breaking Convention.
Yes, we do travel in time.
Karen and Fiona are the Seed Sisters, a pair of herbalists working with traditional English medicines.
We were on a market stall in the ancient market town of Hitchin. We had a moment where we were transported back to the 12th century, and we were on the stall with the same herbs.
I mean, you don't mean just metaphorically, you mean you actually travel back in time.
We felt as though the sights and smells of that ancient market were around us. And that was facilitated by the use of cannabis, outdoor organic cannabis.
And there's a poetic side as well.
Take a goose and a crow in a backside show.
One of the most popular talks at this convention comes from the poet John Constable. For years, he's been writing poetry through the voice of a character called the Goose, one of the forgotten prostitutes of medieval London. And the inspiration for the Goose?
The vision was certainly precipitated by what I've called an heroic dose of LSD. I wouldn't advise people to try this, taking a huge dose of LSD, but I would say I took a lot of precautions, trying to empty myself, you know, of my own mind, my own chatter, my own noisy, my own ego, however you call that.
Talking to John, sitting out on the lawn by the Thames, I can't help feeling that for him, the truly mind-twisting experience is London itself. I envy him that connection.
William Blake spoke of London as also embodying spiritual states, and that to me is a really powerful thing about cities and their magic, because it's about tolerance and an openness to new ideas.
Perhaps it takes a heroically lysergic experience like John's to reconnect to this city's ancient spirit. Do you have time to recite a poem?
What comes from underground isn't subject to the rule of fear. It must have given you a start to find me so lysergic, dear. When it comes to stealing hearts and healing rifts between our hemispheres, there's no trick I wouldn't pull to entice you. Over here.
For the world, I'm Leo Hornack in London.
When you first see the road sign, it is jarring. Sure, I'm used to school crossing signs with the silhouette of a child walking, but this sign, sitting just north of the San Ysidro border crossing to Mexico, shows the silhouette of a family of three running across the highway. It's a remnant of the 1990s, when so many immigrants crossing the border were struck by cars and trucks on Interstate 5, that the California Department of Transportation actually commissioned a series of signs to warn drivers. Now just one of those signs is left, and it won't be replaced when it's taken down. Cindy Carcamo is a reporter for the LA Times. She says people aren't crossing the border like that anymore.
If you look at the apprehension numbers for U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the apprehension numbers are way down from, like, let's say the 80s and 90s. So there are fewer people coming through that area clandestinely anyway. And if they are coming clandestinely, it's a lot more undercover than it used to be. They're using different means. It's not like it was in the 90s, especially after Operation Gatekeeper, which was an operation by the federal government to really fortify that area. And also they had put in some kind of fencing through the median. And it had an effect. It stopped a lot of human smuggling, but it also moved it farther east. So the sign became sort of irrelevant over the years. And they decided as the signs came down that they would just not put them up anymore. And there's just one left now.
I mean, the image of a running family is kind of grim, but it does communicate quite quickly the potential hazard for drivers. Apparently, it was an artist named John Hood who came up with the design. Do you know the backstory?
At that time, there were just so many fatalities along the highway that Caltrans decided to build the sign. And so he was a graphic artist at that time, and he told me that he was inspired by photographs in the media of people crossing the border and wanted to be able to caution motorists, but wanted to do it in a way that would be effective. So they ended up settling on a three-member family unit, and especially the girl with the pigtails. You know, everyone kind of focuses on that and how she's almost floating in some way,
right,
to kind of convey urgency and to convey flight almost, right? So
yeah.
I think the idea is that drivers might have more sympathy for children and might be more cautious.
At this point, these signs are iconic. I mean, they've appeared in TV and movies and inspired different versions. But there are people who don't like the signs still. And I'm just wondering, in the current political climate, what do critics single out about the sign?
I lived in Southern California. I remember listening to a lot of debate about the signs. Some people, you know, really thought the signs were necessary and thought there was a use for them. Other people thought that it was too sympathetic. I spoke with a woman who, when she still drives past the sign, she almost has this like visceral reaction to it where she feels like it makes immigrants look like animals and uncivilized people who just cross. And she was an immigrant herself. She didn't cross that way. She crossed at a time where it was a lot easier to cross. But still, like, she feels very offended by the sign and thinks it should just come down, especially now that there's really no use for it. And then other people, you know, are not critical of it, and they see it as art now. It's something else. It's evolved. So it really runs the gamut. And even when the image goes down, it's still going to be this image that kind of harkens back to California's past. You know, California really was on the front lines of the illegal immigration debate. It's largely outdated now, but its meaning persists and remains relevant.
That's LA Times reporter Cindy Carcamo. Finally today, there's a small town in Slovenia that's beyond excited about its most famous daughter. It's the hometown of Melania Trump, and they're wasting no time there cashing in on the First Lady with lots of Melania merch. Now, if only she would pay them a visit. Anna Nemcova has been writing about this for the Daily Beast. So first of all, Anna, where in Slovenia is Melania from, and what kind of town is it?
It is a beautiful little place about 1 hour away from the capital of Slovenia, Ljubljana. So you drive through picturesque hills and you arrive to the side of the Sava River. And you see this medieval castle on top of the hill and little houses scattered all over the hill. That is Sevnica, Melania's hometown, which has a population of 5,000 people.
Wow, it sounds so picturesque, and this is the place she grew up. What do they think of her there? And tell me the name of the town again.
Sevnica.
Sevnica. Are they proud of her in Sevnica?
people are proud of her, and people are very curious about her life, about her past, about her present, about her future. So people in Sevnica are talking about her a lot, and many people cash in, actually, on Melania's name. They open businesses that are either called Melania or the First Lady.
Hey, what kind of things do they sell in businesses like Melania?
Melania cake is quite popular in Sevnica. It is sold at the best coffee shop called Central Cafe. It is a big, sweet, beautiful cake, which could remind you of Napoleon a little bit. And it is so all sold out by the end of the day, they say. And if you go up the hill to the castle, you find the whole store selling the First Lady wine, the First Lady sausages, salami, the First Lady chocolates, and M apple pie. It has a big M in the middle of the pie.
Wow.
And a few American flags with Prva Dama, which stands for the First Lady, on them.
And when was the last time she was back in Slovenia?
According to some public sources, the last time she visited was in 2002.
Do we know why she doesn't want to go back?
That is the biggest mystery for many people, and they have different answers. And one of them is maybe Slovenia knows too many details about her past and the past of her family, and it's a small place. Many people gossip, and she's trying to avoid that place. Or one of the authors suggested that the immigration process might have been the reason that there were some issues with her visa when she was moving to the United States. And so Melania decided just to put that part of her life behind her and draw a line. My feeling was that she's been busy. But people hope that Melania is going to visit Slovenia very soon, because Trump invited the president of Slovenia to visit the First Lady's hometown soon. So we don't know if Melania is on her way home or not. That is the intrigue for many people.
Anna Nemtsova writing about Melania Trump and her hometown, Sevnica, for the Daily Beast. Thank you very much for your time, Anna.
Thank you, Marco.
And that'll do it for us from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.